Okay. I don't know if Rabbi Kelman, if we can pull him up to welcome us. We'll see if we can get his picture on it. If not, let me do the welcomes. Those who have been with us for a long time will recognize that I'm not in my normal place. I'm actually in my office, and when I came here to escape the snow that's coming to Northeast Pennsylvania tomorrow morning, I forgot my microphone, so I'm just using an earpiece, but apparently you can hear me well. If not, let me know. We have some people on with us who have never been with us live, so just to let you know, you can type in questions over there on the left. A number of people have emailed me, people who don't listen live, that I should repeat the questions, so help remind me to repeat the questions if I forget. Before we begin, I want to call your attention to what's in the middle of the screen here. Jewish medical ethics are in the news the last few weeks, like never before, to my recollection, and everyone seems to have an opinion on it. The impetus is, of course, the Rabbinical Council of America's backtracking on almost 20 years of support for brain death to now leaving it as a question whether it should be supported or not. And there's been all sorts of stories in the news, so this looks like it'll be a beautiful event in Vermont with some of the important people who've been in the center of these debates, as well as I'm sure they're going to talk about other things. If we get Rabbi Kelman up in a minute, maybe he can tell us a word or two about this. Also, I think maybe they'll put on the screen, or I'll put it on another time. I'm sure most of you have seen the ads for the trip that I am leading this summer, July 21st to July 31st, to Central Europe. It will be a trip unlike other Jewish heritage-type trips. So if those of you listening live and on tape, if you can't attend, either it's too much money or you're busy, it is certainly something to recommend to others, to recommend to parents. There are a few different Jewish heritage-type trips, but most of these trips are simply, they include Jewish sites, but they're basically Jews who want to go see sites in Europe and they want to be with other Jews, they want to have a minyan, they want to have kosher food. Our trip will be very different. None of the other trips go to the places we will go to, really off the beaten track places. We're going to go to Boscovitz, where you see a shul with writing all over it as if the people didn't have Sidurim. There's no Jews in Boscovitz. You don't know tours go there. You need to hire a driver to take you there. And we will go to the cemetery and talk about the Gedol Yisrael. And every place we go to, we're going to speak about the great sages who were there. This is really very similar to the trips that Schneer Lyman years ago, the very popular trips that Schneer Lyman used to do. Although I obviously have my own take on doing things that he didn't do, things that appeal to me. We begin in Budapest, end up in Prague with loads of places in the middle. That also actually relevant to this semester. We were supposed to begin with the Stipler, and we are going to begin in a few minutes with the Stipler, and then after the Stipler, move on to Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. I look forward very much to doing Rav Meir Simcha. He will be done. However, since I am so busy at the moment preparing for the summer, I'm the tour guide, so I have to speak in all the different places. For the price of the Europe trip, you can later on just go to Torah in Motion and click on it. It gives you everything, gives you the details, the price. Since I am going to be the tour guide and I need to prepare for this, I figure it's best to kill two birds with one stone to be prepared. So therefore, following the Stipler, we are going to do the Chasam Sofer. It's hard to imagine someone as important in the last 200 years as the Chasam Sofer for Orthodoxy, because part of the trip will be going to Pressburg and Bratislava. We are actually staying two nights in Bratislava. Not that there's two nights worth to see there, but it's very close to Vienna, and there's a nice community there, and there's some things to see, so we will go from Bratislava to Vienna. I will not be speaking about, I will not be showing you pictures of the various tourist sites. I have to keep some good stuff for the summer, but we will be focusing on the Chasam Sofer. Following that, we'll be moving into the Ksav Sofer. In the summer trip, by the way, we'll be going to his kever as well. Lots of people go to the Chasam Sofer's kever. I don't know of any tours that actually go to the Ksav Sofer's kever and speak about this other Gedol Yisrael in that cemetery, or Chaim Sofer. the Machane Chaim, and I'll talk about it when we get to the Ksav Sofer. And following that, I also want to deal in before the summer with a certain Rabbanim from Prague, Rav Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, really the last of the great chief rabbis of Prague, maybe the Note of Yehuda. Basically, I want to cover some things from Mordechai Bennett, because we will be going to Nicholsburg. We will even have lunch in what used to be an old shul, now is a hotel, but you can, in the dining room, you see the shul. And we will be on the street where Shimshon Rafael Hirsch lived, where you still see mezuzahs in the doorways. It really is something. I will do our Mordechai Bennett and other Gedolim from Nicholsburg. That's the plan, at least. One or two more technical things. Although they do charge now, a very nominal fee, the cost to put on not just my lectures, other lectures are much more than this. So again, I just ask if anyone enjoys it, if anyone we see here, we thank Charles Greger and Marjorie Munsterberg for sponsoring this class. If anyone who wants to sponsor future classes, we would be most grateful. It helps spread the good work the Torah in Motion is doing. In addition, if you don't want to sponsor a class, you don't even necessarily have to actually give money. You can go online and download. And that's a great way of giving money to Torah in Motion. There are hundreds and hundreds of classes, over 1,000, on all different aspects of Jewish thought, halacha, everything you can imagine. And for a couple dollars Canadian, you can download these things, listen to them, and that really is a great way to give money to Torah in Motion and help keep this thing going. There is no other site like this. YU Torah has many shiurim on it, but it's not interactive. So we really have to give Rabbi Jake Hellman credit for originating this format and really being on top of it. Those who want to catch up on what we have done, there is almost 100 lectures of mine on various Gedolei Yisrael on the site. And all that can be downloaded, including downloaded much cheaper as bundles, where you get them much cheaper. You get a whole semester, you get 60 or 70 at a time. In addition, those who are signed up this semester, if you happen to miss a class, they will email it to you, the link. So before I begin, I'm getting a private message that Rabbi Kelman wants to say a few words. So without further ado, before I start, Rabbi Kelman, if we can hear you. Well, it looks like they're having some technical difficulties there. I will get a private message sent to me if we can hear Rabbi Kelman again. In the meantime, I'm going to begin. Let me clear this now. As I said, tonight, we're looking at really a great figure, a very learned figure, a figure of unquestioned piety, a figure who was great influence on the Haredi world, and also a figure who I think, at least most of you agree with me, his outlook will be very problematic, at least for most of the people listening tonight. And we've had this before. We did classes on the Satmar Rav, which I think at least people have told me. I gave a very sympathetic portrayal, although pointing out certain problems. We will see problems. When I say problems, I mean for people who have a more of a modern Orthodox, religious Zionist, or even American Haredi outlook. There will be real problems with many of the things the Steichwar says, and it's an old problem. What do you do with someone who, in so many ways, is a model to aspire to, but certain things just don't fit in with your hashkafa, your outlook? In fact, I actually think this is one of the benefits of the more modern Orthodox or centrist Orthodox perspective, in that they really do accept the truth from where it comes, and the great defect, those who've listened before know I believe this, the great basul of Haredi ideology is precisely the litmus test and the disqualification of those because they don't fall into line with certain viewpoints. And those who follow the news will know that even figures today, not just figures of the past, who is greater than Rav Avadi Yosef? And because he doesn't toe the line of the Haredi perspective on conversion. He and Rav Amar are simply read out of the fold, almost. But let us begin. I assume Glenn means there's a delay in the sound. I haven't heard from anyone else, so I will keep going. If you are on wireless, Glenn, that's often a problem. Wireless sometimes has some problem with the sound. One more comment of introduction before we begin. It's not an accident, because of what I just said, that people that we've spoken about, Tzvi Yehuda Cook, religious Zionist figures, they had very little to do with the Stipler, precisely because of the type of Haredi that he represents, and which has now become much more important, although when 40 years ago these were really a minority, the outlooks are so very different than the religious Zionist perspective. And the reverse is also true. The religious Zionist perspective, when you hear some of the rhetoric of the Stipler against religious Zionism, you don't find this in other parts of the Haredi world. Sometimes I wonder if this sort of Haredism represented by Rav Shach and the Stipler, and you find it in B'nai Brak, will reach a point where it's really fundamentally regarded as fundamentally different than other forms of orthodoxy. We haven't reached that point yet. I do think it's telling, though, that some of the more extreme views of the Stipler, which appear in the Israeli biographies, do not appear, at least as far as I can tell, in any English works, and they don't appear in the Art Scroll biography. I think it's clear that the American Haredi perspective is not really, they can't find peace with some of the extreme views of the Israeli Haredi perspective, and therefore they prefer just to leave these things out. And we will talk about this. Haredi spiritual leadership in the early years of the State of Israel was obviously centered on the figure of the Chazon Ish. We spoke a good deal about the Chazon Ish early on in the very first year of these classes. It was the Chazon Ish who formulated the unique Haredi perspective, the Haredi vision, and he was the one who could really move the Haredi street. And when you think about it, it is amazing. He dies in 1953, and in 1943, he wasn't that significant a figure. He only comes to Israel in 1933. He starts becoming a figure in the 1940s, but still, if you'd ask who the leaders were of the Haredi world, it wasn't the Chazon Ish and B'nai Brak. There were Rabbanim in Jerusalem who were better known. After the war, and especially when the state is declared, he becomes the address for really the whole Haredi world in Israel, or most of the Haredi world. I shouldn't say the whole Haredi world. There was still an element in Jerusalem, which was a more moderate element. In fact, if the Haredi world today could really trace its ideological origins not to B'nai Brak, but to Jerusalem, by which I mean men like Rav Zalman Meltzer or the Chevron Yeshiva, it would be a much different Haredi world, a more moderate Haredi world. Mitzi Pesach Frank, they really had a very different perspective, and there was battles. We're going to speak about one of the battles soon, a halachic battle between Jerusalem and B'nai Brak, and Jerusalem really lost. And we'll get back to that. Following the Chazon Ish's death, actually it was 1954, if I remember correctly, not 53, the Haredi world did not immediately anoint a new successor. What we've seen really in the last 40 years is that the old Haredi model, the Haredi model from the early 20th century was, at least they wanted there to be a sort of a Moetzes Gedolei Torah, a group of great Torah scholars. It never really worked out. And since really Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski's time, what you have instead, before him he didn't really have this, but since his time, what you have instead is what I have called the papal model. That is, the Moetzes Gedolei Torah of Agudas Yisrael is a fiction. The Haredi world, and this is acknowledged by Haredi writers themselves, the Haredi world instead looks to great sages. Today, of course, is Rav Yashuv, I guess you could say Rav Chaim Kanievsky, and if there's a problem, they don't go to a Moetzes Gedolei Torah to solve it. They go to these figures who really serve in a papal model. They give the decision, and that's the decision. And you can trace it from the Chazon Ish until today. You know, obviously, you have Rav Shach and after a shach the sniper took over, and then after Mayav Esrim when the sniper, when Rabbi Yosha is not around, there'll be a new one. That's the model that the, and it makes more sense. The Moetzis model never really worked, and if you know about the history, we spoke about it, Rav Shach, the battle with the Gerer Rebbe, it doesn't work putting people together like this. So you have this papal model. Now, after the Chazon Ish's passing, there was a period, really, of, well, it was more than 10 years, where you didn't have one figure who came to the fore. In fact, during that period, the Moetzis Gedolei HaTorah did function more than they had functioned, and they have functioned since. You didn't have one, really, figure who was the undisputed leader in it. You had some. You had Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky, and you had others, but you didn't have this one figure who really equaled the Chazon Ish. You had the Brisker Rav, but he was also, he was not involved so much in politics. But within the next two decades, after the Chazon Ish's death, another legendary figure emerges to the fore, and that is Rav Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky, known as the Stifler. We're looking at his picture here. He never would have the same universal approval in the Haredi world that the Chazon Ish did. But he came close. And unlike the Chazon Ish, who had a great deal of admiration and esteem in the religious Zionist world, the Stifler never had any of that. He never entered into the religious Zionist world. But he did become the most important leader in the Lithuanian world of Haredi society, and the fact that he was the Chazon Ish's brother-in-law, he married the Chazon Ish's sister, that meant that he was part of the royal family that was the Chazon Ish's family. And this was of great significance in enabling him to rise to his level of power and esteem. In fact, it was he who set the groundwork for Rav Shach's assuming control after the Stifler's passing, and even at the end of the Stifler's life, Rav Shach becomes this dominant figure. The Stifler really deserves a lot of credit for bringing Rav Shach into this world of really of leadership. Rav Shach really becomes a leader in Haredi Orthodoxy in his 80s. And the Stifler really was crucial in bringing him in. The Stifler was living right near him in Bnei Brak, and he saw Rav Shach as following in what he believed the line, that what they call the Hashkafa, that's the term of Bnei Brak, the Hashkafa of the Chazon Ish, and he wanted Rav Shach to be the next generation. If you read the letters of the Stifler and Rav Shach, you see that there are other great Haredi Gedolim. They don't say who they are because their names are left out, but you'll hear them say, well, this Rav, he's a big Talmud Chacham, but he's not suitable for leadership because his views on certain things are not totally in accord with Das Torah. If you think of the other Haredi Gedolim, some of them were more positive to religious Zionism, others didn't want to toe the Aguda line completely, that sort of thing. In fact, I thought, when I was younger, I thought that everyone really in the Haredi world, in the Lithuanian Haredi world, that is, was really a follower of the Stifler, because certainly almost everyone was. And I thought the same thing about Rav Shach. I was in for a rude surprise. It was 1992, or 1991 actually, and I was in Germany researching my dissertation, and I was ended up Shabbos in a place, Cologne, nice little city in Germany, not much there, a beautiful shul. If I recall correctly, it was not destroyed during Kristallnacht. I don't think it was the one after Kristallnacht, but I could be wrong. No rabbi, although there was a Chabad person who was sort of functioning, and I was there for Shabbos. In my little hotel, right near the shul, there's this, obviously, Haredi person there, in the garb. So, of course, we start talking. Other than the Chabad rabbi and me and him, we might have been the only Shomer Shabbos in all of Cologne. There's not much there. Although there is an old mikvah they discovered, a medieval mikvah, so it's worth going to Cologne. It turns out that this guy was from Kol Chazon Ish. In Bnei Brak, there's a kolel, it's called Kol Chazon Ish, established, the Chazon Ish didn't run it, but it was established by people very close to the Chazon Ish, and his parents were from Germany, so he knew German, and he was traveling throughout Germany and Switzerland, raising money. So he came to Cologne, and he really knew how to work the people there. It was very nice watching him on Shabbos, and he was there to collect money. So all Shabbos, we spent together schmoozing. And I could not believe when I heard from him negative comments about Rav Shach, you know, in the Lithuanian world. And then when I heard from him negative comments about, not respect for the Sipor, but negative comments about his method of learning, that too I was totally unaware of. And he explained it all to me. With the Sipor, although he deserves a lot of respect for being the brother-in-law, he said his method of learning is not the Chazon Ish's method of learning. And Rav Shach, he had other reasons. They didn't like, the Kol Chazon Ish never accepted Rav Shach's political guidance, just like, incidentally, the Briskers in Jerusalem never did. So let's talk about the biography. The Sipor was born in 1899 in the Ukrainian village of Tahan, a small Ukrainian village. This is all ironic, because the Sipor would become, as I mentioned, the leader of Lithuanian Haredi Orthodoxy, and yet his background is quite different. His father was a follower of the Hasidic master, the Hasidic Rebbe, Rav Mordechai Dov, before the Sipor. And that's where, by the way, the Sipor gets the moniker, the Sipor. Some people refer to him as the Sipor Rav, as if he was the Rav in Ordos Sipor, or he was even a rabbi there, not the Rav. That's not it at all. He should be called the Sipor Gaon, or just the Sipor. This comes from the fact, this connection to this Hasidic Rebbe. The court was in Ordos Sipor. After his father's death, the father died when the Sipor was only 11 years old, his mother, actually moves to Ordos Sipor to be near the Rebbe, and it's because of this that he's known as the Sipor. He was only in the city there for about 6 months, and it's time for him to go to yeshiva. He goes to the Navardic yeshiva at the age of 11 and a half. Very young, much younger than is typical to go to yeshivas. You didn't have people that young in, let's say, Volozhin or in Slobodka. You had, every now and then, you have an exception, like I think the Major Teriwoy. I think he was 13 years old when he came to, we've spoken about him many times, Rav Shlomo Palachek, the first great Torah scholar to come to America, Lithuanian Torah scholar to come to America, not to raise funds, that is, to come to settle permanently. There were other great Torah scholars, but the first universally recognized great Lithuanian Torah scholar, he came to teach at Yeshivas Rav Yitzchak Elchanan. He taught for a number of years. I do not believe there are any Talmidim left of the Mechitzer. He died in the early 30s, so I don't think you could have any, although until recent years, you still did. He's the one, the famous story I've told many times, where when Yeshiva was down on the east side and he was living in Williamsburg, he comes and he sees the boys playing basketball one day. Jeffrey Gurak mentions this right at the beginning of his book on sports in America, and he says that, why didn't they let us play sports? We would have been the same Talmidei Chachamim, we would have had a childhood. Yes, Shlomo reminds me of the Ritbaz. We gave a number of classes on the Ritbaz. That's true, although the Ritbaz only stayed for a couple of years, and the Ritbaz always claimed that he was here temporarily. He came originally to raise money for to publish his Yerushalmi, and then he ended up staying, and while he was here, he always claimed it was temporary and that he just had to get enough money to go to the land of Israel. But the Mechitzer was coming. Dr. Revel brought him in to teach Torah here, and he taught Torah for a number of years. And then he got this gum infection, which today can be cured by antibiotics, and it killed him. I think he was 51 years old, 52, but if you go to Israel today, there's Palachek's. He has numerous descendants who are religious. And after him comes Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. God works in mysterious ways. Had the Mechitzer not had an early demise, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik never would have come to America. Had he never come, Joseph B. Soloveitchik never would have come to America, because it was Rav Moshe that he brought him here, and American Orthodoxy would have been very different. So that if you look back, you could say the Hashgacha Pratis wanted, I guess, Orthodoxy in America to develop in a certain way, and the Mechitzer went on to his eternal reward early. He was, of course, the great student in Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who was a Zionist, who was Mizrahi. He comes to Rav Yitzchak Yochanan from the lead of yeshiva. So that's itself significant. But he was 13 years old, and that was unusual. When he shows up in Volozhin, the Netziv says, what is this? This is not a nursery school here. Some yeshivas, people think that these are great yeshivas when they really are more of like high schools for people of the younger ages. For example, Baranovich. Rabbanan Wasserman's yeshiva was a yeshiva for young people. If you were 11, 12, 13, 14, you can go to Baranovich. And then you can graduate there and go on to one of the great yeshivas. Baranovich was not one of the great yeshivas at the, like a Tells or a Slabodka or a Mir. I mean, it was more of a high school type of place. Well, how did the Stiper end up in the Navardic yeshiva at age 11 and a half? And how does a kid, a Hasidish kid in Hornistopol, end up in a Musar yeshiva, the Navardic Musar yeshiva? Well, the answer is simple. The Navardic yeshiva, unlike other yeshivas, all yeshivas send emissaries out to raise funds. And they send them all over. The Navardic yeshiva sent emissaries out to find students. And the Navardic emissary came to Hornistopol. They went, like I said, all over Eastern Europe. They were the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yosef Yoizel Horowitz, sent him out to recruit, and they convinced the mother to, his mother to allow him to come. In fact, it wasn't just one Navardic yeshiva. There was a few different Navardic yeshivas, and eventually, I think it reaches like 15 different types, or 20 different branches. There were small yeshivas and bigger ones, and then there was the main Navardic branch. So, if, let's say, you didn't want to send your kid all the way to the big Navardic, you'd send him to the local Navardic. It's sort of like Lakewood has little branches, kolos and things like that. That's exactly what Navardic was. And it was this effort that built the Navardic yeshiva, and it allowed it to have all these branches. Now, Navardic, we haven't really spoken about Navardic that much. We spoke about it a little. It's, for those who read novels, it's immortalized in Chaim Grada's work. In the yeshiva, two volumes of the yeshiva, you get what Professor Torsky, my late teacher, called the best portrayal of the Chazon Ish. And it's a fiction, but it's he was a Chazon Ish student. But you also get there the best portrayal of the Navardic yeshiva and the Navardic mentality. Because Chaim Grada, for a time, was a Navardiker. And he writes about this what it meant to be part of Navardic. And he writes about it elsewhere also. He has a book, a short story also called The Quarrel, which Joseph Telushkin put into, it's a nice little movie, it's an hour movie. We have it here at the University of Scranton, actually. I bought it. And it's a debate between a Musar teacher and a secular teacher. It's basically how one should live after World War II. And give Grada credit, in the movie at least, and I think in the book also, the Musar teacher comes out looking better. But this was a Musar person, a Navardic person, if I recall correctly, in The Quarrel, the figure who he portrays. So the classic portrayals in Navardic, but not only there. They're also found, someone asked me to type the name of the book of, the Chaim Grada is The Yeshiva. It's two volumes. Everything by Chaim Grada is amazing and worth reading. Chaim Grada's widow passed away last year while we were doing our classes, and we spoke about how we still don't know what's going to happen to his archives. People would come all the time to Chaim Grada. They want to speak about Chazon Ish, and I know someone who knew him pretty well, and he said Grada was very annoyed with this. He goes, he wanted people to come speak to him about literature, his writings, and all they want to do, all these Orthodox people want to do, is hear stories about the Chazon Ish. But Chaim Grada was one of the only Talmidim. He might have been the only student the Chazon Ish had in Eastern Europe, or at least the only one that we know of. Once the Chazon Ish goes to Israel, he has students. He has Tzvi Yehuda, who you can hear his recollections of Torah in Motion. He spoke at Torah in Motion about 3 years ago. He was a private student. These were people who just came and studied privately the Chazon Ish, and there were a few others. But in Europe, and Chaim Grada, of course, after being such a close student, decides to abandon Orthodoxy, and that's the great break. He never went to the land of Israel, Chaim Grada, even though he would have been given great honors there. Many people thought he should have won the Nobel Prize, not Isaac Bashevis Singer, and Grada thought that Singer was a manuvel. I don't know how you translate a manuvel, but they didn't like each other, and it continues. They interviewed his widow a few years ago before she died, and she had terrible things to say about Singer. He couldn't go to Israel when the Chazon Ish was alive, because then how could he go to Israel without going to see the Chazon Ish? And he couldn't see the Chazon Ish because they had such a close relationship, and then he abandoned everything. He wanted to be part of the big world. So there's a lot to be said about Chaim Grada, but for our purposes, if you want to have the best understanding of what it meant to be Nevardic, and we don't have Nevardic anymore, and there's the Yeshiva, but it's not real Nevardic, you have to read Chaim Grada. You can also read other things. Moshe Silberg, who became a Supreme Court Justice of the State of Israel, he studied Nevardic, and he has a memoir writing about it in Hebrew, not in English. David Fishman from the Jewish Theological Seminary has a wonderful article about Nevardic, called Musar and Modernity, about what it meant to be a Nevardiker. And finally, Benjamin Netanyahu's father-in-law was a Nevardiker in Europe. But Netanyahu's father, I think, is 100 years old now, Benjamin Netanyahu. And his father-in-law, I think, is 99 years old. And he's published, I think, two volumes of memoirs. Maybe the second one is not really a memoir, but more of fictional. He was a Nevardiker, and then he gave it up and came to Israel and became a chalutz, and became, in the 1950s, who was Orthodox in Israel? If you want to be part of this new idea, you became non-religious. And then, I think in his late 80s, Netanyahu's father-in-law, I forget his name, his wife, Sarah's father, he comes back to religion. And now he's a complete Shomer Shabbos. And Netanyahu's wife is not religious, not Shomer Shabbos, but Netanyahu's actually, his father-in-law was helped to be brought back by Netanyahu's brother-in-law, Ben Artzi, who's very much a right-wing religious Zionist. He just published his book on Rav Kook. He wrote a doctorate on Rav Kook, and I published in the book. And he became religious first, and I think he had a great influence in bringing his father back to religion. And if you follow the Israeli press, you know that Netanyahu's brother-in-law often has choice words to say about Netanyahu when it comes to Netanyahu's politics. We might think of Netanyahu as right-wing, but from his brother-in-law's perspective, he's pretty left-wing. Yeah, that's it. It's my quarrel with Herschel Steiner. Thank you very much, Bill. But the movie that Telushkin made, which is really wonderful, that I don't know if it's even still available. I have it. If I had it on DVD, I could send it to someone, but I think it might be on VHS, in which case I wouldn't be able to send it so easily, but that I think is just called The Quarrel. Just to give you one, I mean, what everyone knows about Nevardic, we know something about Nevardic, is how they would go into a store. This is how it's described, at least, a pharmacy, and they'd ask to buy nails or something like that, and then the person would look at them like, you're crazy, you know, buy nails? This is a pharmacy. The whole point was to destroy your sense of ego. To destroy your sense of ego. There's different philosophies. The people at Rechir Yaakov Weinberg thought this was a very negative approach. And the Altar of Slavutka believed in building people up. And godless Adam, the greatness of man. Whereas in the Vardic, they spoke of shiftless Adam, the insignificance. The Altar thought that you show people that they're a creation of God. They can reach great heights. And that would bring you close to God, and that's what you're supposed to do. And Nevardic is sort of like a military academy where they try to destroy your individuality. And then when you have nothing left, you know that all that's left is a Kadosh Baruch Hu, who is God, and you connect to Him. Two different approaches. Rav Yosef Yoizel was an ascetic. There was a time he lived all by himself, and at least the story is, there was two holes in the wall, right? One for Milchik, one for Fleishik, to be passed. Very different than the Lithuanian method. I think the equivalent of a nail story is if you call up your local kosher pizza shop and ask for a reservation, they think you're crazy, you know? It's all, and they would walk around with dirty clothes. So someone once asked one of the Nevardic figures, the Rambam says that a Talmud Chacham that has a stain on his garment, it's Chayav Misa. Doesn't mean literally Basin will kill him, but it's deserving of death because people look at it and say, this is what a Torah scholar is? It's degrading to the Torah. And the Nevardic answer was, that That's okay. The Rambam is speaking about someone who has a white shirt and has a stain. Now look at him and say, what a slob he is. However, our entire shirt is dirty, and therefore the Rambam's words don't apply for us. Now, I'm asked, how is this approach supported in the poskim or the Baalei Masorah? Well, first of all, you don't need poskim here. It's not a question of poskim. If you ask the Baalei Masorah, they had texts. We have, first of all, we have ascetic texts, and we have texts that Jews speak in terms of Shifus Adam. But, you know, when you have a figure like Rav Yosef Yoitzel, you don't need it. You make your own texts. You know, you don't need, you know, Yishol Salanter, I mean, you had certain texts you can study, and some of these texts, by the way, can be read quite ascetic. I don't know, and you can read the number of the classic Musar texts, the Chavos HaVavos and others, you can read some of them in accordance with the Navardic approach. You don't have to, you can read them differently, but you can, even if it's Dohak, you can read them this way. But truthfully, you don't need to read these things. When the Baal Shem Tov comes on the scene, you don't have to ask, you know, where's the Baal Shem Tov's, you know, tradition or anything like that. Because if you have a great idea and you have a great teacher, then you can make it work. You can make it fit. Yes, Professor Alan Nadler, the way he got this relationship was as follows. Professor Tversky, who was a great fan, I know this from my own experiences with Tversky. Professor Tversky even said that the portrayal of the Chazon Ish in the yeshiva is the best portrayal. The only inaccuracy is that the Chazon Ish there is portrayed as a figure that people know him. So, for example, the local yeshiva Bachrim show him respect, and that's not true. Now, why, at that time when he was in Europe and Grotto was with him, he was a nobody. No one knew him. Chaim Moshe Grudzinski discovers him by accident, sitting in the back of the Beis Medrash. Why Grotto did it because he wanted to have these two figures. You know, the Musar figure and the anti-Musar, that is the Chazon Ish. He wanted to have them both as significant figures. He doesn't portray the Chazon Ish as one of the, you know, the greatest Gedolim, but he portrays him as a significant figure. He wants to, so they can play off each other. So Tversky invited Chaim Grotto to come up to Harvard to give four lectures on Yiddish literature in Yiddish. And Nadler's job was to pick him up at the airport. In fact, he picks him up at the airport, and at that time, Nadler was actually serving as a rabbi at one of the shuls in Boston. It's that shul, I forget the name of it, Charles River Synagogue. Grotto, this is just an interesting story. I heard it from Nadler. Grotto wanted, when he picked him up at the airport, Grotto wanted something to eat. So Nadler doesn't know where to take him, so Grotto says, well, let's go to McDonald's. So he goes to McDonald's, and they sit down there, and he gets a hamburger, and Nadler's not eating anything. So Grotto looks at Nadler and says, you don't think this is kosher? He holds up the burger, he says, it's glatt kosher! and he eats it. That shows how far Grotto came from his days with the Chazon Ish. But Nadler owes an eternal debt to Grotto, because Nadler didn't know this, so no one really knew this, that Grotto was also, I mean, he was a great Talmid Chacham. He should have known it from early on, but he knew the Lithuanian literature. Not just he was a Talmid Chacham in Gemara from learning with the Chazon Ish. It was he who suggested to Nadler that Nadler do his dissertation on Pinchas of Plutz. And that's the book that Nadler wrote, the wonderful book on the Mitnagdim. It's focused on Pinchas of Plutz. It was Grotto who suggested. No one had ever written on it. No one had ever studied these writings in probably 150 years. Harvard had all of them, and Nadler looked into them, and that's, you know, this is from I can't remember if it's an actual student per se, but it's the Mistagim and the Vilna Gaon's tradition. Yeah, of course, that's a Gemara, but if it was just a Gemara vibe, yeah, that's not enough. I mean, you know, the Rambam also, if I'm not mistaken, quotes the Beferish, and is in Hilchos Deos. That gives it more significance, because then you can't say we don't hold it, I think. Maybe it was Burger King. Okay, you know the story better than me. So let's go on. In addition to attacking, though, Navardic for what they thought to be divergence from the Musar tradition, this wasn't where Yisrael Salanter taught, and this wasn't part of Jewish tradition, they also attacked the Navardic, that is, the Navardic was attacked, for not really producing Torah scholars. The Chazon Ish himself in Emunah Bitachon attacks the Musar movement in the censored version, which has recently appeared in print. And I don't think there's any question he's referring to Navardic first and foremost. And yet, it's a bit of a canard. The idea that you couldn't produce great Torah scholars because the stipler is as great as they come, and he comes out of Navardic. So I think the best you can say is that it makes it a lot harder to be a great Talmudist coming out of Navardic because they focus on all sorts of strange things. Just to give you an example, do you know they used to confess their sins in Navardic? Like they would get together and people in a circle, they would confess their sins one to the other. Who ever heard of such a thing? But that's what they did. And they did all sorts of weird things, and they focused so much on non-Musar at the expense of Talmud. It was a bit of a strange place. But it was the Stipler who developed his Talmudic learning precisely at the Navardic Yeshiva. I will say, however, that when you evaluate some of the Stipler's extreme positions, we can trace them back to Navardic. In some ways, he's more extreme than the Chazon Ish, but we can trace back to Navardic, I think, some of the extremist positions of the Stipler. And just to give you some examples, Navardic was strongly opposed to secular studies. This wasn't the case in the other yeshivas. The other yeshivas were opposed to secular studies in the yeshiva. The Sid was opposed, they all were opposed, but when you were finished with your Torah learning, and you wanted to then go on and get some sort of secular education, although some did not like it, but for the most part they were lukewarm yeshivas, or slightly opposed, and some were not really opposed at all. There was extreme fanatical opposition to this in the Navardic yeshiva. I guess the parallel will be in America. Think back to the great Haredi yeshivas in America in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. You had Torah V'das, you had Chaim Berlin, you even had Mir. In those places, everyone went to college. They went at the Rosh Yeshiva weren't crazy about it, but they knew you needed parnasa. So they all went to school at night. At night, then you know what is the Ikar and what's the Tafel. The girls are not there at night. You know that. So that was what they did. Tells always was against it, but they didn't have much influence. Then Lakewood comes on the scene, and Lakewood becomes powerful with a strong anti-secular studies, anti-college, and that's from Avraham Cutler, who already in Europe was known as extreme in these areas. The just like in Israel, you could speak about the complexion of Haredi society coming out of B'nai Brak, the Chazon Ish disciple of Shach. In America, Haredi society is really developed from the imprint of Rav Aaron Cutler. If it was Rav Ruderman or Rav Kamenetsky or others, it would be a very different Haredi society. In fact, in the 1950s, Rav Huttner and others, they wanted to open up like a Lander College, what a Lander College is today, and they got the charter from New York State to open up a college, like a Torah college, because they thought Yeshiva University was too much to the left, and they were going to even give a doctorate in theology, and Rav Aaron Cutler shut it down. So I think that's the parallel. Navardic is Rav Aaron Cutler in the opposition to secular studies, and the other yeshivas are what was like in Europe. Even in Pressburg, Bratislava. We will be going to Bratislava in our trip this summer. Students got secular educations. Even in the time of the Chasam Sofer, they got secular education. And the Chasam Sofer himself educated his children. And afterwards, Yaakov Katz went to Pressburg. So many great people, and we'll talk about it next semester. The Aruch HaShulchan, it's a good question you ask, Ethan. In the height of the Musar dispute, you can read about it in the wonderful book, Pulmus HaMusar, on HebrewBooks.org. This is the only book of Dov Katz not to be reprinted. He wrote five volumes of Tenuot, all about the Musar movement, and then he wrote a book on the Musar dispute, encouraged by Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, who told him, you have to tell the story, the truth. This book has not yet been reprinted. I don't know if it ever will, because it will be too controversial, but you can get it, Baruch Hashem, on HebrewBooks.org. You can order it. They'll bind it for you where it says, print this book, and you can read about the dispute over the Musar movement. And by the way, the Musar movement dispute was exacerbated precisely because of Navardic. If you didn't have Navardic, if it was just Sabatka, it wouldn't have been so strong. And the attacks against Musar and against Navardic, and yet the defenses are also wonderful to read. And one of the great defenses is signed by none other than the Aruch HaShulchan, who was the Rav of Navardic There are a lot of other rabbanim signed it as well, but he testified as the Rav of the Vardik. He knows that the people in his city are Yerayim, the Shleimim, and he testifies Edut Ne'emana that the Navardik Yeshiva is a holy place, not like others were saying. You had the Rav of Slobodka, Rav Moshe Donashevsky, and you had others who were trying to destroy the Tavrig Rav, or Rav Borstein, we've spoken about, and others who were trying to destroy the Musar movement. They called it a cult, a sect. And the Aruch HaShulchan, who is living with these Musar people, says these are not crazy people. Obviously, this wasn't the Aruch HaShulchan's derech in his way, but he's saying these are pious people, and these are pious, and these are holy yeshivas. So, in answer to your question, you can go to Pumos HaMusar and see the letter signed with the Aruch HaShulchan at the top defending the Navardic yeshiva, per se. I don't know, Shlomo, what you're referring to when you say you're a footnote, so you have to clarify it. Let me give you other examples. Navardic students, unlike students in all the other yeshivas, Rav Huttner went to school, but you don't say Rav Huttner, all so many went to his school. It was pretty standard, and I'm not even forget about Gedolim. What about the typical Balabatim? Most people came out of those yeshivas. The ones, actually, I shouldn't say, of those who came out, a number of them became rabbis, and others went on to different colleges and things. Especially in the 20th century, you have loads and loads of people who studied, and not just in Slobodka, and not just in the American Haredi Yeshivas. Chevron! Chevron is full of people, Menachem Elon, and so many others. Go to the Chevron Wikipedia Hebrew site, and you'll see all the distinguished graduates who went on to university and still remain part of the firm world. And that's just the distinguished graduates. I meet people all the time who went to Chevron Yeshiva and other yeshivas, and then went on to university, yeah. Navardic students wore beards. I am sure all of you have seen the pictures of the great yeshivas in Eastern Europe, and you see that not only did they not wear black or anything like that, none of them had beards. They used those depilatories. They took off the Rosh Yeshivas wore beards, but the Bachrim never wore beards. They were not supposed to wear beards. It was thought to be your haughtiness or something. Whoever heard of a 20-year-old person who hardly knows anything in Slobodka or Mir or Tells? When I say hardly knew anything, that means maybe you only know four or five masechtas. But that's nothing in those yeshivas. So you've only been in yeshiva 4 years. You only know, maybe four or five masechtas. You're going to have a beard? Maybe when you know 25 masechtas. And you've been in yeshiva for 20 years, and now you're a rav, then you can have a beard. But as a yeshiva bachar, to have a beard never would happen. And that, in all the yeshivas, but not in Navardic. In Navardic, they had beards. This has changed, by the way, today in America. I was in Lakewood. I've been to other yeshivas, although, correct me if I'm wrong, I was in Lakewood about 6 years ago, and I haven't been to the Scranton yeshiva in more than that, even though it's not too far from here. But it seemed to me, my recollection is that a good three-quarters did not have beards. So maybe a half did not have beards. But you had people who had beards. Sometimes short beards, even longer. And I'm not referring to the Hasidic guys who are learning there. But regular guys. That never would have happened. Forget about never would have happened in Europe. It wouldn't have happened in the 60s or 70s in a place like Lakewood. There's been some changes. But you still, I was impressed by how many people in these yeshivas still don't have beards. And it's doubly impressive because a place like Lakewood, there's a tradition of Rav Aaron Cutler, although it's disputed by others that he didn't believe that you could use shavers, that the Naragel shavers, and since you have the halachic problems. But that was how it was in Europe. They didn't shave with shavers. They just they took it off with those ways. You have to be careful with those things. If you left it on too long, it burnt off half your face. And if you go to CVS, for some reason, you can still find the depilatories in CVS. Why they still have them? Obviously, people are buying them. I can't imagine that in my local CVS you had a Shiva Bachrim coming to buy it, but yet I had seen them in CVS, so I don't know. Good for Shiduchim, perhaps. We know also maybe some of the women didn't want a guy with a beard. Possible. When you say, Ovadia, please clarify, I've never heard of this before. It was prohibited. You mean it was prohibited in the yeshivas to grow a beard, or governmental? What are you referring to? I'm not aware of what you're referring to. Sounds like a Baba Meister to me. I don't know which Yishuv. You're referring to the Yishuv in the Ottoman Empire? In any event, in Europe, in the Vardic, they had beards. They wore long black coats. In the Vardic Yeshiva, the Bacharim looked like the rabbis. Again, look at any of the pictures of the great yeshivas. Now we even have videos. I just saw online, by the way, there's a video of the Panadez Yeshiva, and I think it's from the 50s, and it has Rosh Hashanah in it. Look at the pictures. No one wears black. They don't wear black hats. They don't wear black suits. And remember, the whole idea of the Musar movement, other than the Vardic, was dressed stylishly. So they were dressed very stylishly. There's some great pictures of people that we know today with long beards and black coats, and they look very stylish. There's even one where some of the people in the picture are dressed as Arabs. It was like a Purim thing. And that's why I love the hagiographies published in Israel. All these hagiographies of these great rabbis, because they have amazing pictures. And they're not embarrassed to show these pictures, which I think is also great. And they didn't wear black. Black only becomes yeshivish, I think, in the 1970s. I guess an influence of Hasidic culture. But in the Vardic, they wore black. Who wore black in the yeshivas? Again, it's a question of, who do you think you are to wear black? We know what the Gemara says about people wearing black. It's if you want to commit a sin, you wear black and go somewhere where no one knows you. But it became rabbinic garb to wear black, even in the religious Zionist world today, because that's the rabbinic garb. If you're a religious Zionist, you'll never wear dress in black. You'll never have a black yarmulke. All these people don't like these YU. YU is so from today, because all the guys now, or a lot of them, they dress in the uniform, you know, like the Penguins, they call it, black and white, and the hats. Truthfully, these guys, they still believe in college and they're Zionist. They just want to be in that mode, that yeshiva look. And if they were in Israel, they never would dress that way, because Israel, black means Haredi in Israel, and they're religious Zionists. But in America, you don't have the distinction so much. But no one would dress in black unless you're the Rav. So in the religious Zionist world, even though, look at the rabbis. Even the rabbis usually dress in black because it's yeshivish garb. It's the old Navardic joke, you know, this idea that you have to, you know, shifus adam, get rid of your ego. What I'm talking about here, you know, you don't have the right to wear black. It works the other way in Navardic. Navardic, the story is that, you know, these people would sit, the old Navardikers would sit in Beis Medrash and they'd go over and over again, you're a nobody, speaking to themselves, you're a nobody, trying to get rid of any ego. And one day, two old Navardikers walk into the Beis Medrash and they see this guy who they don't know, some newcomer, sitting there saying, you're a nobody, you're a nobody. So one looks to the other and says, hey, look who thinks he's a nobody. You know, you have to be a somebody to be a nobody. It's, in the Gemara, it says, Ovadia, we have Big Talmud Chacham online here, I can say, he'll tell, if this is, I don't know, is this Ovadia, the brother of Dovi Hoffman, if they are two Big Talmud Chacham, maybe you can tell offhand, I can't recall. It says that if you want to do a certain sexual sin, you know, wear black and go somewhere where no one knows you. So it's interesting now, black became a color that, you know, because traditionally there's two colors which we don't like, red for women, and black for men. But in any event, it became the color. It's just one yeshiva. But it's not just that yeshiva, Obadiah. Other yeshivas, too. It was pretty standard in yeshivas that if you wanted to grow a beard, you had to get permission from the Rosh Yeshiva to grow a beard. You could get it for whatever, if you felt you needed it, for whatever reason, or you could get it. But you need to get permission from the Rosh Yeshiva. I don't know if this is the case in Volozhin. I would doubt it. I would assume that when Rav Kook and all these others were in the yeshiva, they had beards. And we do have pictures, by the way, of the Nes Tziona, the Zionist committee, and the underground, the secret Zionist group that Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein was a part of. And if I recall, I'm not 100% sure, if I recall, they did have beards. I think this no beards thing is really from the Musar yeshivas. But I have to check on that. Is there someone you could check? What else did the Navardic people look like that's made them different? They had long tzitzis. Tzitzis that hung down all the way to their knees or sometimes even to their ankles. I don't know if anyone does this today, but that's what they looked like. The Chlal and the Musar Yeshivas, they didn't hang the tzitzis out. In Lithuania, people did not put the tzitzis out. In the yeshiva in Radin, The Rod and Yeshiva. Chavetz Chaim's Yeshiva. They did not put the tzitzis out. And that's doubly significant because the Chavetz Chaim in the Mishneh Berurah says you should wear the tzitzis out. Although last semester we spoke about Rav Abadi, he doesn't think that's what it means. He thinks that the Chavetz Chaim is referring to the people you wear the tzitzis over your garment. When they wear like the talus katan over you, that within that situation, you shouldn't then tuck in your tzitzis into your, you know, you should let the tzitzis go. But not if you wear your tzitzis under your shirt. Although most people understand the Mishneh Berurah is referring to taking the tzitzis, actually having the tzitzis out. But in the yeshivas, they didn't wear that at all. In fact, my Rebbe, one of my Rebbein who studied in the Mir, told me about how in the Mir itself, I'll tell the story. It's not such a great story, but I guess it says something about the time. The explanation in the Slobodka Yeshiva, he was a Slobodka person, a mere person, who then went, his name is Shlomovitz, who then went to Shanghai. The story in the Mir Yeshiva was the reason the Friedrich Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, was, he was very ill. He was, I don't know exactly, was he quasi-cripple or something towards the end of his life? Already started in Europe, if I'm not mistaken. Was a punishment because he once asked a Mir Yeshiva student why during Shema they don't take their tzitzis out and kiss it. And the Yeshiva student made a joke that because we don't wear tzitzis. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe took this literally, seriously, and started telling people in the Hasidic world that look at these Yeshiva students, they don't wear tzitzis. And therefore, as a punishment for that from God, he was punished with his physical disability. Now, obviously I don't believe this. I don't even think it probably ever happened. But the fact that this was the lore, you know, the tale in the Mir Yeshiva in the 1930s says something, first of all, about how they viewed Chabad, not so positively. And it also says something about how they dressed, that they didn't wear the tzitzis out. And we've spoken before in this article, and of course you don't wear tzitzis out because the Ari holds that the tzitzis have to be in. But in the yeshiva world, they didn't wear the tzitzis out. If no one has done a history, a sociology of the American yeshivas the way I would do it. We have Helmreich and Heilman, the world of the yeshiva, but I'm not interested in the things they're not interested in. The things I'm interested in are this sort of thing. When did the black clothing come in, and how was it justified? When did people start wearing tzitzis out? That's the sort of thing that, as far as I know, no one has documented, and it would be interesting to know. Let us go on. We have two more minutes. So in brief, to sum up, in Nevardic, they had a rejection, I think we can call it a rejectionist stance. Really a rejection of the modern world, of European dress, of European manners, of culture, of education. And that's the yeshiva that the stiper goes to. And he remains at the yeshiva for 8 years, imbibing it. Okay, let's see, Ovadia. Yeah, regarding tzitzis, you're right, there are some who, if I'm not mistaken, Rav Yaakov Moshe Hillel, Yaakov, in Israel, he holds you should have it out, and there's a few others. But if you look in Rav Yosef, as I'm sure you know, he has a long responsum, and many others have long responsum that say that Alpia Kabbalah, you should keep it in. So it's a machlokas, but the truth of the matter is, mainstream, if you look throughout the Sephardic world, until recently, they kept it in. That's the Masorah. Take Morocco, for example. No one wore it out. No one wore it out from these other countries. And that's how I understood it. So yes, black does represent shiftless and modesty, but it's mostly understood in the sense that if you have a reason to be modest, not just to live your life like this. And I don't think the yeshiva world today does not wear black for shiftless or modesty. They wear it because it's their uniform. Okay, I see it's already 10 o'clock, so I'm going to stop here. We have just begun. We have to do the biography. It's an amazing, interesting biography. The Stipler is the only Gadol B'Yisrael, as far as I know, who ever was in an army, a non-Jewish army, and not just for a day or two. We have Gadol B'Yisrael, or we will have Gadol B'Yisrael, who have been in the Israeli army. That's no big deal. That's no chiddush. But we will hear about the Stipler and then the rest of his story, how he comes into the Chazanich's family, and then, of course, his aliyah and his assuming of authority and control in Eretz Yisrael, and his viewpoints, the machlokas he was involved with, and his legacy. So there's a whole lot to say. I will stay on now a few minutes. I welcome, if anyone has questions, comments, for those who are new, we usually stay on a few more minutes if there's any questions. Though I welcome all of you who are new, who haven't been with us before. Already you can see that although the focus is going to be on a figure each week, we end up doing lots of other things. Normally the first 10 minutes I devote to questions and comments that people send me. I didn't want to do that today because it's the first class, but you will see we go all sorts of tangents. But from the emails and from the discussion I get from people, sometimes they say that the tangents, what we call the Derech Agavs, are actually more interesting than some of the mainstream stuff we do. So I'm very excited to begin another semester, and I look forward again as we go through the semester from learning from all of you and investigating our great sages. So when Shlomo, you say you mean since biblical times, if you're talking about the tzitzis, in certain places they wore it over. They wore it over in Yemen. They wore it over when they would go outside. They were in Europe also, they wore it over. However, when people started wearing tzitzis underneath, then they didn't keep it out. And in cultures where they always wore it underneath, they didn't take it out either. At least that's the evidence we have. Now, according to many Mekubalim, the Ari has this notion that the tzitzis should be inside and the tefillin are outside. And you look at great sages, Ravad Yosef and others, you will never see their tzitzis. Their tzitzis are kept in. And in addition to their arguments, Al-Pi Kabbal and others, they always say, they look at what's done, that our Gedolim never wore the tzitzis out. But the Mishnah Berurah says too, and that has become quite popular, no one's done a study on how the Mishnah Berurah has influenced Orthodoxy. If next time you're in a yeshiva sheminyan and you hear people saying Yiskadel, that's only from the Mishnah Berurah. He's the reason why people say it. The Mishnah Berurah has influenced Orthodoxy in many ways, and one of the ways is tzitzis out. The Mishnah repeating Zecher Zecher. That's due to the Mishnah Berurah's influence. And there's many other examples. And wearing tzitzis out is the Mishnah Berurah's influence as well. Did he go to Israel after the Chazon Ish died? I believe he did, on more than one occasion. In fact, I'm positive he did, but I didn't want to say it because I'm not 100% certain. I will look into it. I believe he got an honorary at a different Hebrew university. But as I was talking about it, the question raised in my mind, and I wasn't 100% sure. I will check on it and get back to you next week. I will get back to that. This business. In short, Chaim, remind me next week, at the very end, we're going to deal with how the Stipor, it's not really Chaim Kanevsky, the Stipor before Chaim Kanevsky becomes a Hasidic Rebbe. So remind me that question when I get to it. In short, I don't think it has connection. The Stipor didn't give out Shiraim, but he was always a different type of Lithuanian figure. He was a holy man. The Stipor and also Chaim Kanievsky, and I think that does come out of his Hasidic background. He will do things and say things that the traditional Lithuanian Rav won't do. And it was natural to him. He came from a world where Kabbalah and where, we'll talk about it, but it's an excellent, excellent question. Ovadia. As for the true meaning of the Mishnah Berurah, I mentioned that Rav Abadi in his recent Sefer, he claims that the Mishnah Berurah is only referring to people that if you wear the tzitzis over your shirt, or like the Hasidim do, over your garb, then to tuck it in, that is the fringes, that would be a sign of embarrassment or something. You're embarrassing your tzitzis, you're showing your garb and you're tucking it in, so therefore then leave it out. But if it's, and Rav Abadi himself wears the tzitzis out, if you've ever seen him. But he says that the Mishnah Berurah is not referring to people wearing the tzitzis under their garb, because then you have to then bring the fringes out. But, at least in my experience, most people understand the Mishnah Berurah to be referring to just having the fringes out the way we see it. And the Navardic students, by the way, they would wear these tzitzis over their shirts, those sort of things, and they'd have long, long tzitzis. I have a private email about the Mishnah Berurah advocating young men wearing talis gadol before being married. I don't know what's the, if that's really per se a connection. I mean, that's the German practice, obviously. It's a Sephardic practice. A friend of mine asked Rav Avadi Yosef, he's an Ashkenazi, and his father doesn't wear a talis, didn't wear a talis to his marriage. Could he wear a talis before he was married? If any of you, I don't know, do we have David Eisen? It's Stu Schrader from Beit Shemesh. And Rav Avadi Yosef told him he could. It's not a violation of his father's minhag or anything. Why we don't wear it, it's a question. Why? I didn't recall the Mishnah Berurah saying that. So if he does say that, thank you. If you could send me the exact site. It's definitely not the practice in Lithuania and Poland or any place like that. So if you were not telling me this, I'd be surprised if that was the case. But I take your word for it, but please send it to me. If you're interested in tzitzis, in the classes on Morocco, we spoke about this. In Morocco, no one wore tzitzis. Talis Kata, no one wore it except for the Talmidei Chachamim. They thought that the tzitzis is a holy garb, and therefore you're going to give it to some, you know, we put our 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds in tzitzis when they go to school. Or Hasidim give them tzitzis at 3, when they cut their hair. My kid at 5 years old, they went to school first, they had to wear tzitzis. In Morocco, this was thought to be bizarre. You know, the kid goes to the bathroom, you know, you all know what happens with the tzitzis. And therefore, children would never be given tzitzis in Morocco, and the Moroccan rabbonim write about this. And even the Hamonam, the masses, wouldn't wear tzitzis. It was thought to be haughty. Only Talmidei Chachamim in Morocco wore tzitzis. Because it's no obligation to wear tzitzis, only if you have a four-corner garment. The minhag in Morocco was only scholars wear tzitzis. It's sort of like only scholars would wear tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. That's a very interesting point you're saying, Avadi, but that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the Ukrainian Hasidic thing. Rav Kook wore a strimal. All the Yerushalmis wore strimals. It could be the Stipler did not wear a strimal, as far as I know, although maybe for Benching he did. He certainly didn't wear it on Shabbos. It could be, though, that the Stipler, I'm assuming the Stipler wore a strimal then, maybe for Benching. I can't imagine if Chaim Kanievsky on his own would do this, but maybe he did. You know, write him in a letter. Rav Chaim Kanievsky probably writes about 300-400 letters a day. If you write him a little letter, include a self-addressed stamped envelope, and ask him, why do you wear a strimal for Shabbos for benching, he'll send you back a 1 or 2 word answer. Maybe my father did, or he'll send you, but he will definitely send back an answer. But I didn't know this. There are misnagdim who wear strimals in Israel, not so much in Bnei Brak as in Jerusalem, but I don't know. So if anyone has access, I can find out. That would be worth knowing. I did not know this, so thank you. What does that mean, tzitzis out? It's not clear what that means, Shlomo. Does it mean people in the past traditionally did not wear tzitzis like we wear it, underneath? They wore it, they wore the tzitzis, the arba kavos was the garment. It's like my kids today have tzitzis, their t-shirts. Not like when I was young, you had a t-shirt and you put the tzitzis like I'm wearing now over it. No, you have a t-shirt which has the four corners, so you don't need to have a separate tzitzis. The kids all wear those things today. That's what they did. They would wear garments which had four corners, and that was the tzitzis. So that's like the shirt. And in those days, they didn't tuck shirts in. They're not like today. They walked around with a shirt, like we would have a sweatshirt on, which is four corners. And that's the tzitzis. So the fact that those tzitzis are out, that's not telling us anything. We have pictures. You can see pictures of how Jews dressed, and you can see what I'm talking about. Oh. I'm being told, Glenn, from now on, I think everyone will want to hear what you're writing. So address it to everyone. You're saying the Rav allowed his students to wear his talis, Rav Soloveitchik, wear a talis before your bar mitzvah. Why shouldn't we wear a talis? I mean, when you're bar mitzvah, why wait till you're married? We give up an opportunity to wear a talis, but that's the minhag. I don't know the origin of the minhag not to wear it till you're married. I never looked into it. I'm assuming it won't be hard to find, but that is not our minhag. At least I think for anyone who's not German, I assume in the Netherlands, I think they wear a talis also. Ah, so it's from Menashe Klein gave the stipler. Okay, so he does it out of kavod. Maybe the stipler wore it out of kavod. At the very end, we'll see about the stipler, what he said about the upsharon. He had a very negative view of the Upsherons, but if someone were to be there and ask him to cut the hair, he'd cut the hair. Unlike the Briskerov, who they once gave him a scissors to cut the hair of some kid, and he said, I'm not a barber. He wanted nothing to do with this Upsheron business. I know the Book of Letters. Believe me, I'm going to talk about this Shlomo the Letters, because this dispute between the Stiper and Menashe Klein is really significant, because if Menashe Klein's position would have won out, you could not have Kirov, and it would be the end of the Baal Tshuva movement. And the Stiper really showed great leadership and great wisdom in really refuting and disputing with Menashe Klein, and he even says explicitly, the Stiper, quite apart from halachic reasons to dispute, that the Menashe Klein's approach is simply going to create second-class citizens and of Baal Tshuva. So we're going to talk about that. It's worth. Oh, thank you, Teddy. I see I have a very learned group here. You're keeping me on my toes, but I like that. I appreciate that. You know who we know about this? I'm sure it's in the book I have. Binyamin Shlomo Hamburger has a number of volumes of German Minhagim, German customs, and he probably has a section there about the Talos. If not, I have his email. I've been in touch with him. You can contact him. He knows more about the German Minhagim, the various German Minhagim, than anyone. And it's not the only example. There's plenty of examples of what used to be German Minhagim that then are no longer German Minhagim and vice versa. So the question is, why not to wear a talus, though? I don't know if the Mahariel, you have to let me know if he says why not to. The question is, why wouldn't you wear a talus? Unless you think it's something you're not worthy to, so it's worth looking into. By the way, the Germans don't have the custom that we have of putting the talus over as a chuppah. The Germans actually wrap the bride and groom in a talus. So there's a lot of interesting German customs. Okay, well, you have to. You haven't told me your answer, Glenn. You responded with an answer, so I will look into it for next week. I have all of Hamburger's book, and if not, I have his email address. I will find out about this German practice of wearing a talus. Maybe Sperber has it in his book also. You might recall. A couple of years ago, I mentioned the fact that, the halacha, if you look in the Mishnah Berurah or something, it says you shouldn't make a bracha on a talis katan. And I said that for some reason I've always made a bracha on a talis katan, because you don't make it if you're putting on a talis gadol. And I don't know, just intuitively I felt there was no problem. What's the problem with them? And I read the arguments why you shouldn't. And then I found Rav Moshe Feinstein, who actually said that if there's a break, like you get dressed and you don't daven immediately, let's say like most of us, we might be a half hour later or even more, so you daven, then there's no problem. You can make a bracha on the talis gadol. So I felt good to hear that it's not a bracha on the matala. Because after reading all the arguments why you shouldn't make a bracha on the talis katan after talis gadol, it never made sense to me. And I continued making a bracha on the talis katan. I made it when I was young, probably from 5-6 years old. And the idea that I would stop making a bracha on it, just naturally I make the bracha. So now at least I can say that Moshe Feinstein says there's no problem. You're not davening 2 seconds after you put it on. Make a bracha on the talis katan. So, but I'm not sure. I think my friends all make brachas on the talis katan. I'm not sure what the general minhag is. People can write in. Do you make a bracha on the talis katan? It's a little strange to your whole life make it on the talis katan, and then you get married. All of a sudden, you don't start making a bracha. Although that is how it's recorded in sources, that you don't make a bracha on the talis katan if you have a talis gadol. You know, okay, but that, truthfully, Shlomo, what you're doing is the halacha, as it appears in sources. What I was doing, I did it for years, even, I confess, I did it for years, even though there was no source. I knew of no source, and presumably it could have been a bracha of a tala, but intuitively, I just thought that there's nothing wrong with it, because I read the justifications why you shouldn't, and it just didn't make sense to me, so maybe I was a sinner, I don't know. But then I found Ramosha said that if you don't do it immediately, then there's no reason not to make the bracha on the talis katan. Okay, so your question is for, let's hold it for next week. Please remind me. It'll take us too long, but I don't know if Rav Ruderman was in the Haredi camp. Because if you don't toe the line, I don't know how much you're in. When I say he's not in the camp, Rav Aaron Cutler didn't think he was in the camp. Rav Aaron Cutler kept him off the Moses Gedolei Torah. How could you be a Haredi if you have a college program? So I don't know if, I don't think Rav Henkin was in the Haredi. Rav Henkin wasn't a Haredi at all. Haredi is a more modern phenomenon. Rav Henkin is an old European Rav. He's not a Haredi. So, okay, so I'm in the minority. It's okay, though. I have Rav Moshe Feinstein. So Rav Moshe Feinstein hasn't been thrown out yet. I know they're trying to throw him out. I know the OU is trying to get rid of his psukim, and I know we've spoken about it, but Baruch Hashem, I still hold of Rav Moshe Feinstein. I think I'm okay for that. Okay, well, thank you, everyone. Look forward to seeing everyone again next week. And if you have questions or comments, if I check out and I haven't heard from it, please email it to me. And the beginning next week, we'll start off. I usually spend about 10 minutes at the beginning with questions and clarifications. So I see, Glenn, you're typing, but I'm probably going to be off by the time you type. Okay, the wife of Weinberg told me that Rabbi Ruderman was a Zionist. At least the Chovav Tzion, Rav Ruderman was an amazing person. He was not what we think of when we think of a Haredi, but there could have been an alternate type of Haredi. There could have been he was like, sort of like an American Haredi, but he was. There is an audio tape of Rav Ruderman. You can listen to it. I can send you the link if I can still find it. But someone put on an interview. The Mary Stroll guys interviewed Rav Ruderman for about an hour or so. And he speaks about some of the changes and how that they're more extreme in America than in Europe. And they keep asking him, the Bachrim, well, is that good? Is that good? Should we be more extreme? Maybe we need to be more extreme. And finally, they force him to say, okay, maybe today we need to be more extreme. But he writes about how today the Bachrim are crazier than they were in Europe. So I don't know. If anyone has the link, send it to me and I'll pass it out for next week. It's one of these Torah sites has... this wonderful interview with Rav Ruderman. Okay, thank you very much, everyone. Okay, good night.